This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to today's conversation on the Italian Studies channel of the New Books Network. I'm Ellen Nirenberg from Wesleyan University, and I'm delighted to be here with Giorgio Bertolini, who is professor of film, television, and media at the University of Michigan, and is an award-winning scholar known for his groundbreaking work on Italian cinema as it reaches across the Atlantic. We have for some time been the great beneficiaries of Professor Bertolini's painstaking and thorough scholarship on early Italian cinema. In reality, his research in cinema studies extends beyond transatlantic Italian cinema and cinematic culture to include, for example, studies of Serbian filmmaker Emir Kusturica. We're going to return to the transatlantic aspect of Giorgio Bertolini's scholarship as we go along in our conversation, which today centers on his recently published book entitled The Divo and the Duce, Promoting Film Stardom and the Political Leadership in 1920s America. Published in the Cinema Cultures in Contact series with the University of California Press. This remarkable book tells the story of the relationship between celebrity culture, charismatic leadership, and national sovereignty as it plays out on both sides of the Atlantic from roughly 1917 to 1933 or so. Bertolini's cast includes Woodrow Wilson, Mary Pickford, Douglas Fairbanks Jr., and Rudolph Valentino and Benito Mussolini, respectively, the Divo and the Duce. Bringing together star studies, cinema studies, political science, Italian studies, and American studies, we learn to think in new ways about cinema, political authority, masculinity, and race in Italian cinema and beyond. Giorgio Bertolini, welcome to the Italian Studies channel.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Divo and the Duce, Promoting Film Stardom and the Political Leadership in 1920s America, consists of three parts, which track more or less in historical order with some overlaps and some flashbacks, we could call them, from about 1917 to the end of 1933. And at the end of the first part of your book, you neatly lay out two questions that allow me to ask you to describe for our listeners the shape and the scope of your study. First, you ask how two racially othered foreigners, and that is the Divo Rudolph Valentino and the Duce Benito Mussolini, became leading figures in America. The second question you pose for yourself is how two icons of chauvinist Latin masculinity became public opinion leaders in a nation undergoing a major democratic expansion in terms of gender, equality, social mobility, and political representation. So could I ask you to describe the organization of your study and how it allows you to get at these questions?
Certainly. Well, thank you. this is a great question, and it comes obviously at the end of the first part before I develop the sections on Valentino and Mussolini. Now, these questions make sense if we have a way to deal with the two, you know, Valentino and Mussolini, somehow on the same ground, on the same perspective. And the problem is that they're both very different. They're different from one another. Valentino was born in the south, in the province of Foggia, in 1895, and became famous in March of 1921. Now, dates here are important. Mussolini was born in 1883, which means 12 years earlier. He became prime minister at the end of October 1922, which is about 18 months later. And then for about 5 years, they're both famous. As for the domain of their, you know, professional excellence, if we can say that, one is film, one is Hollywood, and the other one is politics, and particularly Italian politics. So on what ground do we deal them, do we treat them together when we ask the question that you just asked? How is it possible that these two icons of chauvinist Latin masculinity became leading figures in America? So in my approach, I changed perspective over time. There are three major methods, and the methods I've been using in this book is the third one. But for a long time, I struggled with two, which I thought were helpful, and in reality, in my view, were kind of misleading. The first one was to compare Valentino and Mussolini in terms of their screen persona, that is, how they appear in photographs, in film, but also in accounts in the press, whether it's the film trade periodicals or the political press. There are ways in which they are characterized as persona, as individual with physical, with gestural tendencies and so forth. The second sort of ground of comparison is the context. Well, how do I compare sort of a film context where you have film spectators, fandom or early instances of fandom and film periodicals to a political arena where you have parties, where you have ideological confrontations and so forth. And that made, had I stuck with those two perspectives, the screen persona and the context, I would not have been able to really understand why they became famous in the 20s. What made me jump to a third method, which doesn't mean dismissal of the first two, means complementing this first two, was understanding that between their image and their reception, there was a class of individuals, which I would call, let's say, mediators, publicity men, ambassadors, businessmen from Wall Street, studio executives, who had an interest in making sure that these two were to become famous and popular. Now it's easier to understand why were these two icon of chauvinistic masculinity famous in America? Well, because you have to look at the interest of these groups, and you have Hollywood interest in promoting new, exciting, appealing, provocative kinds of celebrities, and you have political centers like the State Department, economic and financial centers like Wall Street, who have an interest in basically play down the anti-democratic regime that Italy is during fascism, and push for a personalization of their politics, because the personalization makes the regime acceptable, and it's important to accept fascism because for Wall Street means that JP Morgan and other banks can do business with Italy after the end of World War I, and so in times of reconstruction. And in terms of the State Department, because Italy can finally be serious about paying back the debts that it owes to the US.
So what's the aha moment? What's the epiphany that brings together Mussolini and Valentino together because they never met, right? At least so far as we know, they never met each other literally. So what's the thing that brings them together?
So a great question again. So the as it often happens, the sort of center of gravity of research lies outside that research. So my work was on Valentino Mussolini. And then suddenly, leafing through a periodical, a trade periodical named Motion Picture Magazine, I find in the February 1927 issue a striking image. It's an image of Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks at their second home in California with some friends, and they're all doing the fascisti salute. And the caption says that they are very much grateful that they had been invited and met Mussolini a year earlier in Rome. And then there is a sentence that I don't know whether belonged to any of the speakers in the image, but certainly was a kind of editorial perspective in the sentences. There is nothing like going to an authority. And I thought, this is interesting on a number of ways. A, because the very sentence, the content of the sentence, like celebrity culture, the authority figures. And the second one is, I did not know that A, Pickford and Fairbanks had been in Rome seeing Mussolini. B, I did not know that they had an interest in politics in the mid-20s. I had heard, and I dig, this is where the historical research helps, I had sort of read somewhere that during World War I, they had lent their talent and their fame to the cause of World War I. But the moment in which I started looking into it, I found out that the Great War is really a place where a number of answers and a number of questions to my research were located. And that's why the first three chapters are not about Valentino Mussolini, but are about what the media shy Wilson did in order to persuade Americans that going to war, despite his earlier promises, was the right thing to do. I can go through some dates here. In April of 1917, April 6, the U.S. declared war against Germany. A week later, 8 days later, Wilson creates a new governmental entity called CPI, Committee on Public Information, which is nothing else but a propaganda office. And then he asked a number of his ministries to organize similar propaganda initiative, which means making sure that the press, newspapers, posters, films, all sorts of media are actually broadcasting the rationale for going war. This is very important because on June 15, 1917, which is the day after the CPI is created, you have the creation of the Espionage Act, which is a federal law still in the books. It has been changed a number of times, but Edward Snowden has been charged on the basis of that law. Now, the Treasury Department is very inventive and comes up with the Liberty Bond campaigns because the government needs financial support, and they create these initiative, and the stars are the one that sell the bond to Americans. And it's not just Pickford and Fairbanks, it's also Chaplin and Hayakawa, who is a Japanese-American actor. But the greatest actor at the time, particularly as a couple, were Fairbanks and Pickford. And it's very interesting because the two who basically sold the war to America as basically the war supposed to end all wars, the war for democracy versus the monarchies of Europe, not even a decade later, were supporting a dictatorship.
Right. So let's just go back to that image, your aha epiphany image, which is Douglas Fairbanks Jr. and his wife, America's darling, Mary Pickford, doing the Roman salute, the fascist salute, their arms up straight, which will eventually look, you know, very much like the salute of National Socialism. And you asked yourself, so they were in 1927, how did they get there? How did they get to 1927 and that particular thing? And you go back to 10 years earlier and still tracking Pickford and Fairbanks Jr., you know, that at the acme of their careers, from what I've read in your book, yeah. And the ways in which they helped Wilson advance the war effort when America entered the war, and then also popularized patriotism, right? I mean, that's the other important aspect of the work that they did, bringing together Hollywood, the State Department of Washington, and New York. Is that a fair characterization?
It is. And the outcome of this is the increased importance of these mediators, of these PR publicity individuals and institutions who are able to use stars as hooks, basically, to sell an idea or to sell a product. And so the politicization of Hollywood and the turning of Washington into I wouldn't say glamorous, but certainly into a place where a celebrity operates. Those are things that the First War accelerated.
So, Georgia, could I ask you to, for our listeners who might not be so familiar with cinematic culture in the silent era, well, as they say, films were never silent at that time, but what an experience would have been for them, and what are the kinds of materials that they would have been seeing, the kinds of things that you precisely unearth in your archival research? What are the kinds of documents, and what's that experience like for them?
For them, meaning?
For the spectators, for people who are consuming cinema around that time.
Yes. So what you start having in the early to mid-teens is this alliance between film studios and periodicals. If you pick up a periodical from 1917 and you start having many of them, because you start having the increased power of fandom, of stardom, and thus fandom. Fandom basically is the sort of, you know, affectionate, repeated following of a star by a moviegoer. You see that these periodicals are filled with photographs. Where do they get them? They get them from the studios. So from the mid-teens, say, you start having the film industry that certainly explores Western, gangster, comedy, melodrama, but learns the value of turning moviegoers into repeat moviegoers. And the key technology for that is the star. Pickford and Fairbanks are the all-American stars. But that's not enough. You also want to expand storytelling to other areas and include stars that don't look necessarily like Fairbanks and Pickford. And that's where the fascination for someone maybe darker, someone who has a very different way of moving on screen, comes in for both male and females. And so the late part of the teens and then the 20s is really the period of the explosion of film stardom. And that's the key technology for the national development, the national success of Hollywood, and after World War I, I would say even of internationally speaking.
Mm. So thank you for explaining the term stardom, which is in the title of your study. I was wondering if you could, for listeners, also gloss Divo and Duce, the other two important terms of the title of your work.
So Divo clearly comes from opera. And it refers to, usually it's in the female form, and it refers to the sort of star performer who's supposed to have divine features, meaning it's not, he or she is not one of us. It's someone who has divine gifts for delivering music on stage. The Duce is a term is an Italian word that comes from the Latin ducere, which means leading. It's basically leader. What's interesting is that while we often associate it with Mussolini, because it seems nobody else adopted that expression, Mussolini himself had a newspaper called Il Popolo d'Italia. And at the time when Wilson was particularly famous and celebrated in Italy, and this was in 1918, he titled cover of this newspaper by calling Wilson the Duce of the Free People. And so it's basically, you know, an expanded, augmented leader in ways in which were not really common in Italy. The prime minister was an average person, was not someone whose private life was of interest to anybody. And so Duce clearly expands the understanding, the aura of the political leader toward heroism, glory, larger than life. And those are obviously features that Mussolini had all the interests of appropriating in order to establish the cult of his own leadership.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
All right. So those are the three poles. Then the Divo, the Duce, and Stardom are going to be these three poles around which you drape the tent of your study. But you know, what's interesting to me is, especially since Mussolini is one of the characters here, is the perhaps the absent term from the title, which is fascism. And in February of last year, of 2019, you published a piece in the blog attached to the Washington Post, drawing our contemporary period, so today, into proximity with the era that you discuss in your book, roughly, again, the end of World War I to the very early 1930s and the advent of sound cinema. And your blog post was tantalizingly entitled, When Americans Loved Benito Mussolini and What It Tells Us About Donald Trump's Rise. And I think it could be particularly interesting for readers to hear you talk about that post, and then more generally, the similarities between Trump and Mussolini. I know that you have some things to say about that, but also the distinctions between them. And then perhaps something about the crisis of authority and what that's got to do with masculinity, both for Mussolini as well as Trumpian America.
Absolutely. So in that blog, I tried to use what I learned in my work on the 20s to read the present. And I think one of the first line of the blog is, I'm not comparing Trump to what Mussolini was in Italy, but I'm comparing him to how Mussolini became popular in America, at least in the 20s. And I say Mussolini and not fascism, because the fascist ideology never really made it here, aside from groups of fascist loyalists. But the hook, the attraction was Mussolini as a strong leader, a strong anti-democratic and very effective iconic leader. Now, these similarities between the way in which Trump became president and the way in which Mussolini became popular in the US are not necessarily linked to the ways in which the two of them look, okay, or the two of them sort of operate, but the ways in which certain machinery made them appealing. Now, let me ask you a question. Would Trump would have been elected had he not relied on the coverage that television gave him? No, he wouldn't. So there is a way in which the mediators have to be looked at when we compare Trump and Mussolini in America. Secondly, there is also a message that is very similar. After World War I, there was a pushback against democracy, against the Wilsonian democracy, and there was a need for strong leadership. Then in 1919, approved in 1920, you had the amendment for women vote. And so you have the understanding and the appreciation for a strong male chauvinistic leader with a nationalist brand of effective governance who's really not interested in democracy. And what I found interesting as I was looking at Valentino Mussolini is that there are quotes attributed to Valentino in which he says democracy is for losers. Every nation needs a strong leader. And interesting, there is even more similarity between the way in which Valentino speaks in these interviews and the way in which, or is made to speak, and the ways in which Trump presented himself as, you know, let's cut bureaucracy, let's get things done, pro-business, and so forth. Now, a number of historians have stressed how Mussolini was one of the appeal of Mussolini was his anti-Bolshevism. And that's obviously there, but that does not explain the celebrity status of Mussolini. You cannot become a celebrity if your main message is, I'm anti-Bolshevik. That clearly attracts, you know, sympathies, but the celebrity appeal is something else. And, you know, in the case of Trump, if you want to continue or close the circle of similarities between Mussolini's message and Trump's message, is that Trump obviously was against liberals, environmental protection, and absolutely committed to the well-being of business, you know, unfettered business relationships. And
it's fascinating. I think that, one remembers the interview with Steve Bannon, who talked about the importance of the work of Julius Evola, which was also foundational to an understanding of fascist ideology in Italy at the beginning of the regime, right? So it's both terrifying and really interesting. So let's go back to mild-mannered Woodrow Wilson for a moment. And is the expansion of women's rights, of social mobility, of, if we will, a kind of a democratization in granting the franchise to women, for example. So are Valentino and Mussolini then receiving the projected desires unconscious for the strong man, that it's no longer palatable for the American electorate or populace to openly say that, and they go to the movie theaters and work it out that way?
Yeah, I mean, you do have individuals who find Valentino's misogynist pronunciation and Mussolini's own misogyny horrendous. But you do have publications who capitalize because these pronunciations, these statements are very interesting, meaning they are newsworthy, they sell, particularly in the context of post-1920. And it's as if Hollywood, in the case of Valentino, realizes that a person like him, who seems to be pushing back against women's rights, can do things that Fairbanks cannot, can push the envelope in ways a Fairbanks cannot, which means that you can have Valentino do a number of things on screen that are very contradictory. And so he's very sentimental. he seems to be at times very, very rough with women, but also very, very romantic. Plus in real life, so to speak, let's say in the private life that the studio sold, you have Valentino being paired oftentimes with very strong women. So the opposite of the kind of companion that in statements he seems to be preferring. I mean, all of these, the women that Valentino sort of hangs out with are strong, professionally capable and competent and successful women. And on, whereas Mussolini is rather different. I mean, with the exception of Margherita Sarfatti, who was a Venetian Jewish intellectual with whom he had an affair in the early 20s, most of the women Mussolini was associated with were rather traditional or were sort of subservient to himself. But in America, Valentino was able to walk two sort of paths, and on the one hand, being misogynist, being forceful, the strong man, but on the other one, being very sentimental, very romantic, and elicit a kind of erotic appeal that, you know, even a Fairbanks, with whom a lot of, you know, for whom a lot of women felt affection, etc., he was not able to, was not made to elicit. And so there is an interesting case of erotization of his exoticism that went hand in hand with a pushback against women's rights.
Right. But what's interesting, at least in the book, what's so interesting is that the women are everywhere among the mediators, are they not? The presence of women among the screenwriters, for example, at one, who is the screenwriter who is the highest paid of all screenwriters, you said, that was working on some of the films? Jean Matt, who is a lifelong friend of Valentino's as well, right?
Correct.
So you've answered the question, and I didn't mean to reduce cinema goers in the early part of the 20th century as to having, you know, the inability to sit in a seat in a darkened theater and say, oh, well, I can see what they're trying to show me. I know that there's all kinds of agency that we can ascribe to cinema goers. I'm not willing to say that they check their agency at the door or surrender it with their ticket. That's not what I want to suggest. But you did answer my question about the gendered aspects of this, but, you know, crucial to your argument are some ideas concerning the discourse of race, nativism, and isolationism in the United States in the 1920s following the conclusion of the First World War. And so this is the backdrop against which the story of this archetypal Latin lover, Rudolph Valentino, or the projected Latin lover, is acted out. And let's speak specifically about some of the films that perhaps some of our listeners are familiar with, and Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, The Sheik, Son of the Sheik. How do those map out some of these discourses about, again, race, nativism, and isolationism, shoring them up or contradicting them?
So, very interesting question. I mean, the let's take The Sheik because it's of paramount importance in the rise to fame of Valentino, even though it's the second one, right? The first one is The Four Horsemen, which came out in March of 21. The Sheik came out in November of the same year. Now, in The Sheik, Valentino is an Arab, allegedly. And not just any Arab. He's a Sheik, so he's a leader. And actually, the first and last intertitles of the film, you have the word leader in them. Now, Valentino in that film appears to be an Arab who's able to persuade a young British woman who doesn't want to get married, who basically says to a friend who's basically, she's never been kissed. Somehow she doesn't want to have anything to do with men. And he made her fall in love with him, even though it's a kind of narratively unexplained. And because the relationship between a British woman and an Arab man is problematic from a racial standpoint, in the end, you start having doubts, you start having a narrative solution that basically showcases that Valentino is the son of a British man and a Spanish woman. And the Spanish woman explains the fact that he's a kind of a dark complexion. And so her falling in love with him suddenly is safe. Now, this solution, this narrative solution that brings together melodrama and race was not just of that film. It was a staple, a recurring solution of a number of so-called desert novels that British and American literature had been produced for years. And the novel, The Sheik, was one of those successes. And when I say desert novels, we need to understand that it's as if it's a realm of fantasy where forbidden things are made possible for 180 pages. And then in the last 20 pages, you have a narrative solution that made that fantasy somehow legally or publicly legitimate. It's not something that is completely out of bounds, which is like the love of a white woman for an Arab man. Now, why is this possible? Why is it possible to treat Valentino as, on the one hand, completely other, and on the other hand, as just a tanned person? I think we need to go back to questions of and distinctions among categories. One is whiteness. The second one is race. I'm not going to talk about ethnicity because ethnicity in the 20s makes no sense. And I'll tell you in a second why. Italians in the U.S. were, from a legal standpoint, white. They could purchase property. They could marry whoever they wanted. Sure, there were a few cases of in which they were not perceived as white. They were condemned. There was also some violent events that occurred in Louisiana in 1890 and so forth. But by and large, Italians enjoy the perks of whiteness. Now, this doesn't mean that they were not racialized, meaning does not mean that they were not perceived to be biologically different. And by saying biologically different, we mean that they love in a different way. They are violent in a different way. They are in those activities invested with their body. And so Valentino could walk these two tracks and on the one hand be perceived as different, which means kind of forbidden. But there is no actual miscegenation with Valentino because ultimately he is in real life Italian and in the narrative story is a Spaniard. And that allows the story to be safe, but it also allows the story to maintain his own exotization because of his racial difference.
You know, that's it's really fascinating. You also talk about, I'm thinking about how it resonates, this part about Valentino and he's becoming safe or he's whitened or he's made palatable somehow. It compares also to something that you describe happening to Mary Pickford too, and in the roles that she played. Yeah. Right around the 1970s, about the whitening of Mary Pickford. So it's not limited to Valentino.
No, it is not. But in the case of Pickford, we have a different sort of phenomenon occurring. There was no question about, obviously, Pickford whiteness. She was of Anglo-Saxon background. She was born in Toronto. But very interestingly, Pickford was making films where she was impersonating Latina or Native American women before 1917. The moment in which the U.S. enters the war, she drops all those racialized individuals, characters, I should say, and only does Americans. And it's because of, and it's after that period that she becomes America's sweetheart. She's not American sweetheart before 1917. And it's after she becomes American sweetheart that facial cream companies propose her to sponsor products like, you know, facial cream supposed to maintain your skin white. And there are a number of advertisements in the trade press and in film periodicals. So her whitening is a kind of a nationalizing process. In the case of Valentino, one thing I should add is that there was never a strong link between Valentino and the Italian-American community, who in return did not love him much until he was dead. Then after he died, he became, you know, an iconic figure because he was someone who came from the South and had made it, had become famous. But while he was in New York, he rarely visited the Lower East Side, the Italian-American community. And you can see the difference with another Italian who was successful but behaved in a very different way. I'm referring to the opera singer Enrico Caruso, who died actually in 1921. Caruso had continuous relationships with the Lower East Side, to the point that in 1918, he made a film with Paramount called My Cousin, where he played two roles, one of basically himself, an opera star at the Met, very successful, and the cousin of this star, who's a barber and lives in the Lower East Side. And so even fictionally, he went back there. He used to live, eat a lot in the Lower East Side, and so had a number of publicized events linking him, to the Italian American community, even though he lived on Fifth Avenue and used to be a star at the Met. You don't find evidence of that link with Valentino.
So let's go back to, so it's 1927 is the year of the death of Rudolph Valentino, who died of peritonitis, I think, right? It was phony appendicitis, and he really had ulcerated colon or whatever. What was it exactly the cause of death? Peritonitis was the cause of death, but I forget what it was that led to that infection.
We don't know.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
But I wanted to focus on hone in on 1927 again, which was the date of that photograph that you saw of Douglas Fairbanks Jr. and Mary Pickford in the fascist salute and the year of the death of Valentino, because there's another moment where there's a near miss with Mussolini, isn't it? I mean, it's posthumous, but I was wondering if you could talk about the episode of the wreath that appears that's allegedly comes from Mussolini himself.
Yes. So Valentino actually died in 26.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. In August of 26. And he dies in New York because, even though he used to live in L.A., because he was promoting The Son of the Sheik, which was the film that came out posthumously. And Campbell Funeral Home was the place that had his body after he died and was released by the hospital. And there was a reef with the sign from Benito Mussolini and two Italian-American posting guard outside Campbell Funeral Home, and there were pictures taken. And Valentino's friends knew that he was not fascist. Not that Valentino was an anti-fascist. He was mainly not interested in politics in that way. And so there was a kind of violent confrontation. But the press still published these photographs. And the question was, did Mussolini, who had refused to see Valentino in Rome a few years earlier, and Valentino was not particularly known in Italy, by the way, did Mussolini send order someone to place that wreath? And the answer is no. The archive in Rome basically told me that it was the initiative of an officer in New York who just had acted on his own. And Mussolini reprehended him, but he was never really from Mussolini himself. But clearly, this was another opportunity for a kind of convergence between the two, or misconvergence between the two. But it's interesting because the fascists, after his death, tried to appropriate his body and his fame for their own purposes, and Valentino's friends refused to go along with that.
You know, it's interesting when you go into the archive, it's interesting the kinds of things, the documents one finds or one doesn't find. Okay. And the very kinds of the chance to try out your hypotheses or to have them shot down. That's the other thing that can happen when you find archival materials. And I thought it might be useful for our listeners to hear you describe the archival research that you conducted. for this specific book. And I was hoping that you could start by saying a little bit about archival research in general. Just as an aside, listeners should know that an adjective frequently attached to Giorgio Bertolini's research is meticulous. You find this repeatedly in reviews of his work. And so I was wondering if the meticulous film historian and historian of cinema could talk about the archival research more generally, and then specifically archival research for this book.
Well, thank you. The archives are an amazing source of energy for me. And I, you know, whenever you read about a topic and then you go into an archive that is more or less related to that topic, the perspective, the hypothesis, the sort of contemporary preoccupations that inform my initial interest, they tend to disappear because papers and documents speak a very different language. So when I go into archives, I do basically two things. I cast my net wide, and so which means I Xerox or take photographs of an enormous amount of stuff because I don't know what will happen. It's not like going to an archive and I have already an interpretation or I have an hypothesis, but shortly after I have to change it and I don't know where I'll be going. So I collect as much as possible. And in this case, I collected for 5-6 years. I had to go to Chicago, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, UCLA, the Academy. But it was the summer in Rome, which was 5 years ago, 6 years ago, which was foundational. The State Archive, the Diplomatic Archive at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and the Archivio Storico Capitolino, which were places where I basically found the, you know, the correspondence, the critical information, because everything that came from the U.S. embassy, the Italian embassy in Washington, went back to Rome, and those were key documents. The second thing that I do, aside from casting the net wide, is get images. And archive have images. It sometimes surprised me how many historians debate how many images to use in their books or what to put on the cover. Archives have images, and my suggestion is buy those images, and later on, all you have to do is get the permit, the permission to publish them, but you do have them already at the quality you want, and I work with images. I write looking at images because they're very telling, and they provide sources of for future research, and so the image that is on the cover of the book, the two images, one come from Rome, one come from Hollywood, and they're very similar. One is of Valentino with posing with a bust, and the other one is Mussolini posing with his own bust. You know, each one has their own bust, and they're very, and they go together. To me, that somehow, when I found those images, I was able to even imagine the book as an object carrying an argument that is more or less coherent. But the research is energizing, but it's also, you know, it takes an enormous amount of time going through the material after you have secured it.
So you've teed me up pretty well here for what is going to be one of my last questions today, and that is about the transatlantic aspect of your research. Because, you know, across two massive and impeccably researched studies, this one, The Divo and the Duce, and your 2009 study entitled Italy and Early American Cinema, Race, Landscape, and the Picturesque, published by Indiana University Press, you pursue what we could call a transatlantic approach to Italian studies and the history of Italian cinema. I know what I think can be gained by a transatlantic approach, but I really would love to hear you tell me and our listeners what you think about transatlantic studies, specifically with the corpus that you, or the archive, if we could use that word, that you are specifically interested in. I would really value that.
So for me, transatlantic studies means to identify problems that are inherently transatlantic. So it's not a matter of an approach or a perspective that one can develop further invent, but the nature of the problems that you are interested in is inherently transatlantic, or lends itself naturally to a transatlantic approach. So, for instance, the question of migration is transatlantic. In the picturesque book, I had first two books, one on representation of Southerners in Italy before they migrate. Second book, representation of Southern Italians in New York after they migrate. And I needed a link. And the travel, the voyage of this form, of this visual form called the picturesque, followed them. And that was to me the link. So now I have a link, iconographic, ideological, formal, between the two books. So the books somehow became one and became inherently transatlantic because I have a problem. You know, what happened when migrants move together with a visual form that had been used to depict them? Does the visual form travel with them or not? And it did. So that became very easy to deploy transatlantic sort of framework for the problem at hand. The same for fascism in America. You cannot understand fascism in America without doing research in Rome. You have to understand the way in which embassies work, the way in which distribution of films across the Atlantic works, the way in which a number of groups, fascist groups in New York, are interested in maintaining relationship with fascists in Italy. And so that became very natural for me to link the two, because ambassadors travel, both American and Italian, and so they left a trace in both countries, and my job was to trace it.
Yeah, that's so aptly put, and I'm struck by how your focus as a film historian is on the era of cinema. So since the very tail end of the 19th century onward, with a special focus on silent cinema or early cinema and its culture. But this transatlantic, the problems that you describe as inherently transatlantic, one could transpose into different historical periods, right? It need not simply, well, I'm not saying that your formulation of this is simple at all, but it need not only map or track with the great migrations from the 19th century onward. One can obviously think of, you know, travel literature of Italians outside of Italy. And again, following those traces, as you describe, right, whether they be, you know, Marco Polo or in the recent book, Barbara Spackman's recent book about Italian voyagers to Ottoman lands, that's another great example, or, you know, to follow colonial enterprises, which for Italy is particular, right? It's the experience in very late 19th and 20th century of Italy's ambitions, aspirations toward colonial enterprises is quite different from some of the other empires that were established. But it's that transatlantic. It's for the trace outside. It's for the vestige of Italy that is in encounter with something different, something outside of the peninsula, that I think is such a rich vein to mine for locating Italian studies. And the two books that you have ferociously when I think about the footnotes, the density of the bibliography, the command of the span of materials from, for example, in the Divo and the Duce, all of the materials of all of these mediators, and just marshaling all of that into this, again, remarkable study that starts with that 1927 photograph, and from there goes back to recover the U.S. entry into the war and tries to get at the First World War, and tries to get at, you know, how did Pickford and Fairbanks, How did that happen? What does it mean to go to an authority? And that's it. On all levels, on all semiotic levels, is that photograph intriguing, I must say. We are approaching the end of our time. You've been extraordinarily generous with us today, Giorgio Bertolini. But before we close, I'd really like to know what you're working on now.
I am collecting. So I'm amassing material on two sort of projects. One is on photojournalism in the US and in Italy from the mid-30s to the late 50s. And my hypothesis is that there are connections there. Photographs travel, and I'm very interested in the way in which editors work with photographers, editor of periodicals work with photographers, and I'm looking at papers of individual editors who did that, and there are a number in Bologna, for instance. And the second one I'm working on is on, this is purely cinema, is flops, meaning, and I'm actually teaching a class, it's on American film that failed miserably at the box office. And it's not just a film that failed, it's a film that the professionals thought it could do extremely well, kind of blockbuster, and it didn't. And I believe flops are major sources of historical information about the industry and about American audience and about cultural trends. But film history books tend to list only successful films. So there is a way in which, from Cleopatra on, one can imagine a different kind of American film history through the examples of flops. And so I'm teaching this fall the first iteration of this class, and look forward to
So in addition to Cleopatra, what are some other flops that we might consider? What's on, in other words, what's on your syllabus?
I don't want to give away.
That's fine. That's fine. That's perfectly fine. I understand.
So let's say
it'll be for our next appointment. When you write that book, we will talk about the flops that that make up that particular corpus. We are thanking Professor Giorgio Bertolini of the University of Michigan for his conversation today about his study entitled The Divo and the Duce, Promoting Film Stardom and the Political Leadership in 1920s America, published by the University of California Press. And thanks so much, Giorgio, for your time.
Thank you. This was wonderful. Thank you.